This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at acura.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
It's 2007, and we'll start the show this week with thoughts on the Hollywood year that was, and the year about to be. Then, what will it be like to cover Hollywood in an era of blogs and gossip sites? And, for reasons known only to me, we'll finish the show with the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. The Hollywood year that was 2006 actually started in 2005, when Rupert Murdoch purchased social networking site MySpace. Hailed by some as a waste of a perfectly good $500 million, Rupe was leading the rest of the industry into what is the first stages of the internet future. This year's purchase of YouTube by Google for more than $1.5 billion made it official that after an awkward and costly puberty, the internet promise of the late 90s finally had come true. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing depends on what websites your company owns. We're actually beginning to see, not just imagine, but see a time when voice, movies, music, games, and more come from a single pipeline, not just into your home, but out again to anywhere you are. But is it a better world that we're creating? Of course it is! Without camera phones and websites like YouTube and TMZ, Mel Gibson's tirade, Michael Richards' meltdown, and Lindsay and Britney's vajayjays wouldn't have been seen at all. Such internet distractions were widely blamed for a dismal year at the box office back in 2005, but the movie business bounced back in 2006. Sort of. Admissions were still down by 15 million souls, but it was nowhere near the 130 million person drop of 2005, and box office revenue was up a tiny bit. The shining star was 20th Century Fox, with an industry-high $3.5 billion in worldwide box office for 2006. The biggest gross for a slate of films in history. Why? Well, big-budget movies like X3 for the popcorn crowd, mid-priced dramas like The Devil Wears Prada for grown-ups, and inexpensive but daring comedies like Borat and Little Miss Sunshine for the rest of us. The studio made something for everyone, and everyone came. There's a lesson there for Hollywood, if anyone's paying attention. For all that happened, 2006 may ultimately be known as the year of the stories that weren't. Despite all the press about private investigator to the stars Anthony Pelicano, the wiretapping scandal was all fulmination and no culmination. Only one high-profile lawyer and one director have been indicted so far in the U.S. Attorney's far-flung probe of Hollywood's elite. Likewise, the huge online buzz about snakes on a plane proved that internet marketing wasn't the panacea for what ailed Hollywood box office. Good movies still matter. And finally, despite being branded a pariah, Mel Gibson saw his Apocalypto take the number one spot on its opening weekend. Though it didn't ascend to the box office heavens like Passion of the Christ, that had more to do with the Mayan film's limited appeal than Mel's anti-Semitic zeal. So what should we expect in 2007? Perhaps the eviction of Tom Cruise from the Paramount lot and the evaporation of two Jim Carrey projects may hint at the waning of star power and salaries. Less than prayed for box office for the hugely expensive third installment of the Spider-Man franchise could create havoc at Sony. And although it will be wildly underreported, video gaming will continue to grow like weeds. And we here at The Business will be there to cover it all. Good night and good luck. Courage. Keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars. Seacrest out. The web was the big story of 2006 for sure. It's having a huge effect on the entertainment industry, but also on the people who cover it. Laura Halson is entertainment reporter for the New York Times, and Cynthia Littleton is editor of The Hollywood Reporter.
Laura Halson and Cynthia Littleton are here, both of them elite correspondents of this mucky business that is Hollywood media. Welcome to The Business, both.
Hello. Thank you.
It seemed like it was the year of the blog. websites like Perez Hilton and Huffington Post and even my own home site, TMZ, have sort of changed, I think, in some ways, the way that we are talking about what is the biggest story of 2006. And I'm curious to ask you both, as people who work for the trade press and who work for mainstream press, how you think these new media have effectively changed the course of discussion. I mean, have we sort of seen the fabric of the business story change as a result of this new way of covering the business? Laura Holson?
I think the way that we write the story has changed, because people can, you know, hop online and learn something in a second. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in our industry, you know, whether it's newspapers, magazines, of changes. And my feeling is if you, you know, have a good brand and you can bring context to a subject, you're probably going to thrive, because in the end, people are going to want to go to a place that they trust to get, you know, honest information. And I think that, you know, that's going to be really vital and important in the next year or two.
I mean, it struck me that, you know, 10 years ago, after the Mel Gibson H-bomb goes off, so to speak, the thing that would have happened is that some person of interest from Hollywood, a top agent, a, you know, sort of a Mike Medavoy or a Jim Wyatt type person, would have emerged to write the epitaph on that ugly episode in a editorial for the New York Times. And what happened this time is that Ari Emanuel, you know, the firebrand agent of Endeavor, who is the inspiration for Entourage, Ari Gold on HBO, wrote on his blog in Huffington Post. And I'm interested in particular about, obviously Hollywood has embraced this this media, but I'm wondering if the stories that we're talking about are the stories they are simply because of the media that is distributing them. Would the Michael Richards story have been just 4 column inches in the New York Times and out, were it not for the sort of phenomenon of web video?
But here's my question about that. How many people are still talking about Michael Richards? I mean, was it a 2-day story, a 3-day story, and was it mostly an online story? I think it was. What I think is more interesting is the incredible apologies. Like, I think this is the year of I'm sorry.
Year of mea culpa.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I think Michael Richards becomes a much, much bigger story than it would have, or have more legs, because you don't even have to go catch an edition of Extra or Entertainment Tonight. I mean, you're sitting at your desk at work. It's water cooler conversation. You go back. It doesn't take you 10 keystrokes to pull up the video. You can watch the video yourself. Having that video and having that on everybody's desktop at everybody's fingertips, so you can kind of watch it and judge for yourself, is what fuels that kind of stuff and is that democratizing force, if you will. What I think what is interesting about the blogs this year, TMZ, the Michael Richards thing, is that what you've really seen is the value of original reporting. There was some, you know, original, obviously there was some shoe leather reporting that TMZ put into getting the real truth about the Mel Gibson arrest. Mm-hmm. And that just adds, you know, another independent actor on the stage going out to try to ferret out news. And in the case of Mel Gibson, you can argue that, you know, has more than just tabloid appeal because of the very serious issues that it raises. On the other hand, you look at blogs. So I think in that sense, blogs, investing resources and time in original reporting is great because it adds to the mix of original reporting that's out there. But probably the other 85% of blogdom out there is reacting to news sometimes a funny, witty, cheeky, cynical spin on it. I think TMZ took a notch up in people's esteem as a news-providing outlet, in the sense that it had the great Mel Gibson scoop, and it was true, and it was, you know, it was a real story that nobody else had. I think oftentimes, though, on blogs, one downside can be that there's a lot of rumors and a lot of gossip gets out there that, you know, is often just patently untrue. We hear rumors all the time, but right, we ferret them out and go through that process, and it can be, you know, it can be really tough on the people that are kind of in the eye of that storm.
Well, that's what I want to ask you both, is that do you feel added pressure to sort of change the way that you report, given that there are so many blogs out there that will pull the trigger? Are we seeing stories presented before they're cooked, or that you would never you would have liked to see them sort of play out a little more before you thought to weigh in on them?
I think you have to give context. I mean, I think that that's the value, context and brand, because people can find stuff online, you know, as Cynthia said, like in 10 keystrokes, but where, you know, places like The Times, people like places like in Hollywood, The Times, the Los Angeles Times, The Wall Street Journal, you know, the trades, Variety and Hollywood Reporter, if they're giving context to the news, that's what people are going to want, because they can find the news, you know, easily, again, with those 10 keystrokes.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, for instance, like, you know, The New York Times had this big scoop on this anti-YouTube meeting going on, that all these major television networks, Fox and CBS and NBC, were getting together. But the reality is, a lot of people say, well, you know, there's so many personalities at work here. It's such a disparate group with different interests. The likelihood of that happening is, you know, probably I wouldn't bet on it.
Doesn't mean they're not talking.
Doesn't mean they're not talking. Doesn't mean it's not news. But I guess what I'm saying is, in the past, you know, would you have maybe waited on that story? I realize it wasn't your story break. But I'm saying, in this environment of, you know, sort of constant ticker tape news and commentary and snarking, is it becoming harder to cover the business that you cover?
You know, I don't find it harder, I have to say. I don't find it harder at all. That, again, I go back to this notion of, if you're giving context, if you're bringing to the reader something that they can't get someplace else, you know, no. I think it's really more exciting than ever to be covering this business, because there's so much change going on. And if you understand it, if you understand the technology, if you understand, you know, the players, it's kind of the most exciting time. It's more exciting than when I started 5 years ago covering this.
Oh, I mean, I get into the office in the morning and oftentimes, you know, fire up the computer, and I don't even sit down before I'm looking at the, you know, the 5 to 10 blogs, the must-read blogs that I want to see. And oftentimes, you know, those are kind of the substitute for going through the AP wire and the PR news wire that were the old,
right, that you would have
done
10
traditions
years ago.
Of how, okay, what's going on in the world. And I think that, you know, it definitely puts more pressure on stories. You know, we're starting now to get publicists and people trained to know we really need to deal with this in tomorrow's paper, because I promise you at 3 o'clock it'll be on a blog and we'll all be scrambling to react to it in a way that nobody wants to. So that's starting to become an effective wedge in for us. But it's true. I mean, it definitely puts a pressure on it. But, you know, not to sound too highfalutin, but we have to vet things in the same way. We have to talk to every single possible constituency, because it doesn't matter how many blogs it's on. If it's in the Hollywood Reporter and it's wrong or it's skewed or some way, I'm going to get the screaming calls the next morning, no matter how many people may have reported it, however. And they invariably comes down to, yes, but you know, you're a mainstream paper. You are not just some internet gossip. And it's true. I mean, that is the value of what we bring. If you start to dilute that, then you dilute the value of what we bring to our coverage.
Cynthia Littleton is the editor of The Hollywood Reporter. Laura Holson is the entertainment correspondent for The Gray Lady, The New York Times. Ladies, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Things may be changing for Hollywood reporters, but wading through the spin to get to the story behind the story in Tinseltown is still one of the strangest jobs in journalism. A while back, we talked to a group of anonymous Hollywood correspondents about what they go through to bring you something approaching the truth.
Nobody in this town ever wants to say anything on the record. And, you know, it's just such a battle to get anybody to comment about anything that isn't, you know, why my movie should win the Oscar.
I think at this point it would be easier to get Dick Cheney on the record saying that the war in Iraq isn't going well than it would be to get a studio executive on the record saying that, like, one of his projects isn't going well.
I covered Capitol Hill, and I covered the IRS and the SEC, and all of these things are easier to cover than the business side of Hollywood. In Washington, if the Democrats won't tell you, the Republicans will, and vice versa.
When Michael Ovitz was in the crosshairs at Disney, you know, there he would say to me, you know, David Geffen is telling you things, and he is my enemy, so why are you using the things that my enemy is telling you? And I would say, well, the question is, are they true?
You piss off Disney, you can get shut out by ABC, ESPN, the studio. You used to be able to play the studio off the network to get information. Now they're one and the same.
you can just lose my phone number. I mean, the level of threats, 99% of them are backed up by nothing. That just makes you feel like you're going into battle.
Somebody literally asked quite recently, why can't you be nice, the head of a studio? And I, you know, I said, I'm not actually paid to be nice. That's not part of the job description. I try to be nice, but if that nice means only asking questions that suggest that your latest move is brilliant, that I don't get paid to do. Sometimes people think, oh, if I talk to the press, if this gets out anywhere, someone, somewhere, in some office, you know, in on the Sony lot is going to get really pissed off, and there goes my deal.
There is much more of an effort to track incoming phone calls so they can see what execs are talking to reporters. It's ridiculous, the level of paranoia.
I think when I started doing it, people just had, you know, an agent and then maybe a publicist. And now there's like a manager, an assistant, and you know, there's like 17 layers of insanity before you can actually get to the person you want to talk to.
There's a cottage industry of blacks and managers and handlers, and they convince these people that reporters are like loaded weapons, and if they get anywhere near them and talk anything like candid, it could come back to bite them somehow.
It was actually like my first real piece in Hollywood, and I managed to wangle a very high up at Disney during the time that they were so paranoid because of the lawsuits and Eisner and Ovitz and all this craziness. And I did the piece, and it came out, and I was really actually very embarrassed because it was so soft. And yet, that morning, I got a call from one of their flacks at 7 in the morning on my cell phone, just screaming at me and telling me how, and this is the word he used, how disgusted he was with the piece.
I had it on good authority that Meg Ryan was negotiating to star in a movie at Paramount, and that's what passes for news in this town. And so I wrote the story saying, you know, no deal yet, but they're talking to her. Well, the next morning, an apoplectic agent called up from William Morris saying, no hello, no identification, just only, you have done material damage to Meg Ryan's career, and I'm going to tear out your throat and eat it.
If you search for tenderness, it isn't hard to find.
I get quite far by saying, are you kidding? You know, and you don't really expect me to believe that, do you?
But if you look for truthfulness, you might just as well be blind. It always seems to be so hard to give honesty.
You learn very quickly who's going to be honest with you and who's just going to completely bullshit you.
I have wondered that many times myself as to how in the world you get up and lie every day. I could never be a publicist. Where there's smoke, there's fire. We've just seen it be true time and again. We don't care what the publicists say. And you almost kind of just sort of sit there and nod your head when the first round of denials come through because you know that's what they're paid to say. Most lawyers or managers, they won't give you the time of day, but if you know them, if you've done right by them at times, then they'll at least pick up the phone and, you know, grunt once for yes and grunt twice for no. I knew I was starting to succeed in Hollywood when, this is how long ago it was, Jeffrey Katzenberg was at Disney, and he called me up and said, you make me want to vomit. I said, literally vomit, or are you just flattering me?
Honesty is on the other hand, and mostly what I need from
coming up after a short break, the writer speaks again. You're listening to The Business from NPR. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The Writers Guild Foundation's book, Doing It for Money, The Agony and Ecstasy of Writing and Surviving in Hollywood, is filled with essays from successful writers. In installment 4 of our ongoing series we call The Writer Speaks, Winifred Hervey came down to our studio to talk to us. She's best known for writing and creating half-hour comedies like The Golden Girls, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and The Steve Harvey Show. But she started her career as an intern on shows like Rhoda.
It was interesting because I was supposed to be an intern as a writer. But because the writing room in a half-hour comedy is kind of a sacred place, and as I look back on this, I can understand why maybe, you know, they did things this way. I wasn't allowed in the writer's room, even though I was the writing intern. And so I ended up sitting on the set, and I wrote a script from being there on the show. And that script actually got me a lot of jobs. They never bought it. I don't even think they really read it. Usually the comedy writer is the person who never had a date and, you know, is off in a corner by themselves. Yeah, we're all kind of misfits, I guess. I don't know. I don't know if you can pick somebody out.
Here's Winifred Hervey reading her piece from the book Doing It for Money, The Agony and Ecstasy of Writing and Surviving in Hollywood. The story is called Now I Can Laugh Too.
I had just landed my first development deal and was about to adapt a successful BBC half-hour comedy to an American sitcom. Along with the British creator and writer, I would produce and write the pilot based on his original series about a young working couple faced with the unplanned birth of a child. Her mother, a prim, high-strung, divorced blue blood, and his father, a hard-drinking, unemployed, working-class widower, share the flat downstairs from the couple and look after the child. During the pitching process, I notice that whenever the British writer speaks, everyone thinks every single word he says is absolutely brilliant. And I'm no chopped liver. It's the accent, let's face it. Even the most mundane sounds smarter with a British accent. Take aluminium, for example. We immediately decide he should do all the talking. We sell the idea and have a blast writing it. The network loves it. Then we get the phone call. The network wants to use an all-black cast and make the baby triplets. Suddenly, it's not politically correct for both male characters to be unemployed and drinking. This means a major rewrite. After I scrape the British writer off the ceiling, I explain to him that in Hollywood, this is what they do when they like you. Now we have 1 week to rehearse before we shoot the pilot. In that week, two lead actors in the four-actor ensemble are fired. The director barely escapes the same fate. We hire 3 sets of newborn triplets and a couple of backups, which means by law, we are required to have a nursery, nurse, and social workers. The day we shoot, the lead actor comes in swollen and whacked out on painkillers. It seems he decided to have a root canal that morning. Do we shoot? Do we not shoot? By now, both the British writer and I just want the damn thing shot so it can be over. We start shooting and soon realize we're using up babies faster than we anticipated. We start scouring the city for more triplets. Our lead actor is freaking out, which throws off our new actress and flusters the director, who, to our horror, cannot speak when flustered. The lighting is film noir sitcom. The actors playing the young couple decide they can no longer contain their lust for each other and start making out in front of the audience. We have to roll in a screen to block the view. Our backup babies, who are driving in from Long Beach, have a breakdown on the freeway. We send a limo. The studio head has literally growled at me, and the network guys won't look us in the eye. Finally, the babies show up, just as the British writer quits. My producer, an editor, and I began the editing process in a tiny trailer. Before we can finish, we are not picked up. Later, several network executives joke about how much they botch things up. Now I can laugh, too. I can't speak for the British writer.
¶¶ Just to shake things up, we end today's show with the Hollywood News Caravan. As Hollywooders return from St. Bart's gleaming and tanned, show business news begins to trickle in. Digital music is proving its robustness in all sorts of musical arenas. SoundScan reported last week that analog album sales dropped by 5% in 2006, while track downloads shot up by 65%. In other music news, they said it couldn't be done. But satellite radio has finally turned a profit. Having bled hundreds of millions in red ink since its inception, Sirius Satellite Radio signed up its 6 millionth subscriber last week. That astonishing news was so good, it didn't just lift Sirius stock 6%, it even boosted the stock of Sirius competitor XM Radio by 6.6% last week. Meanwhile, in other techie news, Herb Scannell, the former president of Nickelodeon, has resurfaced. Scannell was sacked last year in a restructuring of the house that SpongeBob built. He is now running a decidedly high-tech venture. Scannell is the new CEO of Next New Networks, a collection of community-based video websites that is expected to launch later this year. Watch out, YouTube. Speaking of web video, the more things change, the more they seem to stay the same. YouTube CEO Chad Hurley promised last November that his company would offer a mobile phone version of the video website by the end of 2007. But phone companies have met with limited success in turning your cell phone into a TV with video downloads. Now, they're trying a more direct route in creating a TV phone, by actually turning your cell phone into a TV. Samsung Corporation says it's come up with a way to pick up digital signals from local TV broadcasters. Cell phones using the technology would essentially become portable TV sets that would get the same reception as TVs using antennas. And to think, I just threw out my rabbit ears. Finally, a three-year-long legal battle came to a head last week between two warring camps of super lawyers. Here's what happened. Back in October of 2004, Armstrong Hirsch founding partner Barry Hirsch formed a new law firm, taking with him several attorneys as well as some superstar clients like Julia Roberts and Jennifer Lopez. Hirsch then sued his old partners over a retirement plan dispute. Hirsch's old partners, who represent superstar actors like Nicole Kidman, went apoplectic and countersued, saying Hirsch had looted his firm of clients and cash after their salary spat. Things got so crazy that his former partners even accused Hirsch, a licensed therapist who officiated at Lopez's weddings, of using his training in psychology to manipulate his clients into leaving for his new firm. Last week came a much-needed dose of sanity. Having spent millions beating the tar out of each other, L.A. Superior Court Judge Robert O'Brien ruled that both sides will get absolutely nothing. That's the Hollywood News Caravan, and that's the business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.